This program is usually called Whatever Became Of, but you can hardly say whatever became of Ruth Warwick because she's all over the television screen. And she just closed with a brief run in an off-Broadway play. But I asked her to come here, and she was kind enough to do so, to talk mainly about the film she made, which after, I guess, 30 years, is still thought of as one of the finest films Hollywood ever turned out. I think even Mr. Welles' greatest critic would say it was certainly one of the most controversial films, or the most controversial film ever made. So we're going to talk about Citizen Kane. I might begin by asking you, how did you get the part? That was your first movie, wasn't it?
Yes, it was my first movie. First movie for everyone in it. No one had ever made a film before. I had come to New York from Missouri, born in St. Joe, raised there, and then Kansas City. And my whole thought in life had been to get to the big city and take over for Catherine and Helen. That's Cornell and Hayes, of course. That was my only thought. Films really didn't enter into it. But people are always asking me if I had done a Mercury Theater thing. I didn't, because by the time I got here, he was already on his way to Hollywood. In fact, it just was closing up his last radio season here. I had gotten married shortly after I got to New York. This is a long story. You asked me a question, we'd go around in the barn, but that's me. We had decided after 2 years of nothing much happened in my career, we'd move to the country and have a family. You know, that sort of decision that one makes on paper. It sounds very good. And we'd spent all one season looking for a house and finally found it in Silver Mine, Connecticut. Charming little place right on the river, across from the Silver Mine Inn. Do you know it up there?
No, I don't. No.
Well, it is charming. And we had signed a 2-year lease. It was a barn that had been converted right next door to Norman Cousins, who's now, you know, editor of the Saturday Review. And I got back to town about 5:30, called my service, and they said, "Where have you been? We've been trying to get you all day. You had an appointment with Orson Welles at 1:15 in the Waldorf Towers." And I said, "Oh, don't worry about it." And went over the towers, got upstairs, got there about 6:05, and about 10 minutes after 6, Orson came in puffing and blowing and making all kinds of apologies, saying, "Oh, aren't you marvelous to wait for me? Oh, you're a darling." Great. I said, it's all right. He said, "Well, Ruth, I tell you what it is. I'm going to make this film, and I'm all set with everybody except this one character. And she has to be a lady, a real lady. She's the niece of the president. She's from, you know, really top drawer, blue blood. And there are no ladies in Hollywood." And I, of course, demurred and said, "Well, that's very flattering." He said, "I think you'd be absolutely perfect. Is there any reason you can't fly out and test for it?" I said, "No, you're not in a contract. I was doing some running things in radio, but you didn't have contracts in those days, you know, that you just showed up." And he said, fine, you'll hear from me." Well, when I went home, I didn't even, hardly even said anything about it. My husband asked what happened. I said, "Oh, not much, you know, I'm supposed to fly to Hollywood," but so many people had said that, and anyway, I didn't want to go, really. I'd turned down 2 screen offers, just because I wasn't into films that much. Theater was my bag. And I sort of dismissed it, you know. It sounded nice, and I would have liked it. Well, within 24 hours, I was on a plane. I did think it would be stupid not to go and make a film with Orson, because I, of course, respected him very, very much.
He had just done War of the Worlds, so he was...
Right, very much, and anybody who knew him, I mean, we all... He fascinated anybody that he ever came in contact with. And although I didn't want a film career as such at that time, I thought I would be very stupid not to go out and do... Well, Orson has a way. I mean, you wouldn't think of not doing what Orson asked you to do. It would just be unthinkable, that's all. And, my first day on the set was quite incredible. Naturally, you're nervous. I don't care who you are or what you are when you're going to do a screen test or anything for the first time.
You'd never even tested now before.
Well, I had made a test here in town, a couple of them, actually for other people. You know how you come, you find you get a day's work that way. You get paid and you get the experience, and that's how Fox offered me this contract, and I said no. I turned it down cold. I wasn't interested at all. It was very bright of me. I didn't do it because I was bright, because it was, you know, a regular stock contract. I just didn't want to go to Hollywood. I wanted to stay in New York. I knew a little bit about it, but after all, that was when I didn't care. I was just getting a day's work. So I was nervous a little bit, but the most marvelous thing happened. That, well, it was just marvelous. When we got on the set, I was surprised to find out a little bit that Orson was testing with me. And now I know how really unusual it is. The star doesn't test with somebody who's testing with a role. You know, just, that's rather unusual. I also did not know this was the first foot of film that had ever been turned on Orson Welles. He was using it, you see, to test with me and to test for himself at the same time. So that helped. I was happy I was going to work with him. But when we got on the stage, there was a most awful odor. It really stank. It just stank. And you wondered what on earth it was. Of course, it was new to me being on a real Hollywood stage. But here were tons and tons of old, decayed flowers, wreaths, and, oh, just everything. And a terrible stench. And then
old
we
Ginger saw... Rogers said.
Yes. Oh, I beg your pardon.
That's RKO.
That's right. In fact, all the stills taken of me the first year I was there looked exactly like Ginger Rogers because she was... Whoever's the star, you all look like her. That's why I didn't dig Hollywood. Anyway, there was a whole line of men in business suits and overcoats and fedora hats, you know, looking very strange, standing there in a line in a regular reception. And one of the gentlemen stepped forward and said to Orson, welcome and congratulations on your first day of shooting. This was also the first film, the day of anything shot on Kane. This was the board of directors of RKO, the president, the chairman of the board, the whole board of directors. They had all come out there to, you know, because it had been a year, nothing had happened. And they said, we're sorry about the flowers, but they were fresh when you were due to start production. Well, this, of course, we laughed, and Orson laughed a little hollowly. And then, much to my amazement, he obviously was very nervous, because then they just stood there with their arms folded waiting, say, all right, genius, show us, because here was the boy wonder to do something. And I considered he was completely unflappable. Any time I'd ever seen him before or since. It's the only time I ever saw him. But he began to perspire, and, you know, he was really getting buck fever. He was really embarrassed to be working in front of all these men, and I don't blame him, because it was, you know, they had him, and they knew they had him, and they were really enjoying it. Well, thank God for me, because as a woman, all of my instincts went to comforting him, to helping him. I forgot all about the fact that it was my screen test. It meant absolutely nothing to me. My whole interest was to make him at ease. Here I am, putting Orson Welles at ease, you see, reassuring him, making little jokes, doing things, involving him in things so that he would forget those people. And, of course, it was fabulous for me, because I then became the lady I was supposed to be. Totally, you know, cool, serene, charming, concerned about him. And, well, it was just the greatest break in the world for me.
When did you see, or did you ever see, a complete script?
Oh, yes. Yes, we had a complete script. I could just die because I don't have it now, because my house was flooded out in Topanga Canyon a couple of years ago, and all my papers and scripts and stuff and things like that that you keep are just, you know, washed out to sea. Yes, we had a complete script. And yes, we talked very, very frankly about the whole thing ahead of time. That's one reason why Orson is so beautiful. He is so totally open to his actors, totally open to them, and to his camera, to anybody. He'll, you know, if somebody is interested in the idea and has an intelligent or perceptive or whatever the contribution to make, he'll listen to it. He may not necessarily go along with it or buy it, but he wants to involve his actors and everybody in the project. He had, you know, it's just incredible. Everything that Orson was saying that we would say to each other in talking about the film or talking about how we really felt is so totally what the young people are saying today that it's almost uncanny. The thing that really got him into trouble was his feeling about money and people who have money. And we didn't call it establishment in those days. Establishment then meant the cabinet in and number 10 Downing Street. That was the establishment to us. It was the English, you know, sort of way of doing these. But he said people who have money and who just make money ought to get down on their knees and worship the people who are willing to turn it into creative efforts. So he didn't really have any respect for the people who gave him money. He didn't even respect them for the amount of power they gave him. He said, they're fools. He said, they gave me too much power. You know, this is just wild, because this is what I think youngsters today say, you know, power and money are such corruptors. And if you give it to anybody too much of it, even us, we are corruptible in that sense.
I don't want too much of it.
Yeah, well, I really don't either. And I now can say I really don't. You know, a lot of people say it, and you look at them and say, yeah, do you really mean it? But I do, because I know it is. It's terrible.
When did all the controversy start? When were you first conscious of it?
Well, I knew that we had what was called a closed set, and didn't mean much to me then. Now I know how remarkable it was that really no one came on the set.
They didn't do that in those days.
No. Oh, my God. They begged they begged publicists to come in. They begged people to come in and write about it. They practically, you know, they just did anything they could to get anything written about it. That's another reason why the way Orson behaved is mostly a legend that nobody ever saw or ever heard, because, you know, the publicity departments grind out things and images. You know, my goodness, they still do it. But they particularly did with him, and it made sense. Yes, he could lose his temper. My goodness, who doesn't lose his temper? But as far as the actors were concerned in all of this, nonsense. He was not an egomaniac at all. He was absolutely the best director I've ever worked with in my entire life. Now, I'm talking about Kane now. I'm not talking about the way he acts now. The reason he acts like an egomaniac on the sets now is because most of the things he's doing now are for money. And he doesn't respect working just for money. It goes back to that again. He's taking it, and he's behaving kind of up to an image. He said, they've given me the image, so I'm going to behave like it. Also, he doesn't respect a lot of the work that he does. You know, it's just for money. It isn't for anything. But when he is a disciplined person working on his own thing, there is absolutely nobody who is more polite, who is more kind, who is more considerate, who is more loving. I mean, he simply holds people in his arms, to his bosom, as far as that's concerned, if you're creative and if you're working on the show. Now I go back to that other question. When did I first know about controversy? Quite inadvertently, I did something that for years I felt terribly guilty about and felt sad about. I'm happy to know now that I needn't feel that kind of guilt. I came back to New York after finishing the film, although I had a 7-year Hollywood contract, but because you had to sign that.
That was with RKO.
But I was having a baby. I had my first baby and made my first film simultaneously. And I was called by RKO and asked to come to an interview at 21 and, you know, to talk about, well, I was thrilled to death, of course, you know, an interview at 21. My goodness, this is a very exciting thing for a young actress.
You completed Citizen Kane by that point.
Completed it, came back home, had been home, you know, months. In fact, it was, I guess, January, and we'd completed it in the end of September. So I'd been home some time. And it was with a reporter from PM, which I was glad about, because PM was a very groovy newspaper at that time, the first one that was trying to...
It was owned by Marshall Field.
Yes, but it had a more liberal point of view than any of the newspapers had had
very
at that
liberal,
time.
Very liberal, particularly for that time.
For that time, it was exceedingly so. And I was flattered and pleased and thrilled. And the first question was, as he sat down, now, you know, it's a great mystery, and what is Citizen Kane really all about? And I told him. I mean, we had discussed it freely on the set. Nobody had ever said, don't talk about it. RKO had set up the interview. And I just, you know, as freely as I'm speaking with you now, said, well, it's about a man, one of the, sort of a epitome of the tycoon type of the era of a certain kind of time in America. It's sort of a combination of Hearst and Insull and Fall and all of these people. The kind of man that Orson felt had a great impact on America. And although it was very fascinating and very exciting, and most of those men are very revered, that actually they had a very detrimental effect on America, and that we are being molded by what they did much more than we have any idea of. Well, I hardly got that sentence out of my mouth, and this man, I saw he got this look on his face. I thought he had to go to the bathroom suddenly or something, because he looked, you know, this terrible clutch thing, and he said, "Excuse me, I have to run, make a telephone call. Forgive me, I'll be back." Well, he didn't come back, and he didn't come back, and finally the maitre d' came over with a bottle of wine and said, "He asked you to forgive him, order anything you like, but he had a sudden emergency. He's been had to go back to the office." Well, what happened was he had called his editor and told me this. The editor had phoned, I guess, Luella in, or our first RKO, and said, "Is it really about this?" And I suppose RKO said, "Well, yes, it has, you know, it is about this type of man, this prototype." He then called Luella Parsons and said, "What about this?" Luella was in RKO with the lawyers within, well, by 4 o'clock that afternoon, with a screening of it. They saw it, and she demanded, because I've talked to the projectionist and to Bob Robert Wise, who cut the film, you know, who was there. It was he had to get it out of the can and come in. And
he was an editor then.
He was the editor on, although Orson certainly oversaw every foot of film, but he was the editor. Luella demanded that they burn the negative in her presence on the spot, right in that, in the room there. Well, for years, I thought, oh, my God, if I just hadn't said that, if I hadn't said the interview, you know, maybe it would have been opened at the music hall, which was supposed to open, you see, at the end of the first day of February. And I thought, you know, my God, if I hadn't opened my mouth. Now I do know that, you know, that probably, I don't know, I just don't know. They had all begun to. There had been a number of rumors, and from the various accounts that I read now, you know, they had requested to see the film before this, but hadn't. But when Luella got this call and could quote somebody who'd been in the film as saying that it was about it, you know, they did see it. And I've thought, oh, if it had just been able to open at the music hall ahead of all this kind of thing, you know, maybe it would have changed history. But it was a totally innocent, you can see, I nobody told me not to say that. RKO set up the interview. I didn't dream that I was precipitating anything as disastrous as all
did
that.
Did you tell Mr. Wells about it right away?
I didn't know until years later that this happened. I didn't know this at all until I knew Bob Wise on the coast, and we were friends there, Robert Wise, and he was the one who told me that it was the sequence of events that, no, I didn't know. I had no idea. All I knew was that the opening was postponed from February till, oh, finally, I think it was May before it actually opened.
Well, Charles Higham, who wrote the films of Orson Welles that Ruth Warwick and I were discussing before we began recording, says in the book, and he told me this also, that Hearst and had seen the film at the urging of Luella Parsons, and the first time he saw it, he said it was perfectly all right. He mm-hmm. sort of liked it.
Right.
But she saw it again, and it was she who talked him into blackballing the film.
Well, then maybe this is the story is, I certainly trust Robert Wise's story, because I know he was there. And I certainly don't think that, and by any stretch of imagination, I should feel that I was the one that made the problems for Kane.
Have you ever thought of this? Do you think that your career ever suffered because of your participation in Citizen Kane?
Oh, well, I know it, because can you imagine trying to be a Hollywood actress when your name couldn't be mentioned in a Hearst paper for 5 years, and it was 5 years.
I didn't realize that you were blackballed.
Oh, absolutely. For a few weeks, they refused to take any RKO ads or mention any RKO film at all. Then I think they realized that they would be, you know, the suits, that would be restraint of trade. They would not be allowed to get away with that. So they settled then for blackballing the names of certain actors. They just simply just didn't print them. You know, how are you going to do that? The RKO could sue them, but an individual person could hardly do that. They could just say we weren't newsworthy or whatever.
How did people react to you around Hollywood?
Well, again, if it had happened now, I would have been far more aware of it. I must say I take my hat off to RKO for not being... they had a lot of intestinal fortitude through this whole thing. A lot of spine, a lot more spine, because Louis B. Mayer offered to pay them. The film cost, I think, $780,000. He and Jack Warner and Harry Cohen were going to take up a collection from all of the film people and pay RKO for the full cost to destroy the film. Did you know that?
Yes, I did know that.
They were so afraid that of Hearst's... because Hearst paper and movies were very closely tied in together.
Sure, because Hearst papers were mainly entertainment. He admitted that himself.
Right, right. And the type of people who read the paper were into movies more than to any other thing.
And Luella was in
was
Hearst
the
papers.
Queen Bee. That was the whole thing about that. She was the Dowager Duchess and the duenna and the mother confessor and everything to the whole business. But they didn't. They did go on with my contract, you know, and they did put me in good films, and I had a steady, a steady kind of thing. But now the second film that I made after Kane was Corsican Brothers. I was the leading lady opposite Douglas Fairbanks Jr. There wasn't any other leading lady in it. And they did use a whole full-page spread in the Hearst paper because, after all... small productions and this kind of swashbuckling thing was a very good Hearst thing. And they did print my picture because I was the leading lady right in the middle of a whole half-page spread, but no name. I just didn't exist. I was there, but I wasn't there. And finally, after about 5 years, my agent said, you know, we've got to do something about this, a new agent said, and hired Henry Rogers, the best publicist at the time, who, for a great fee, got me together with Luella, and with the right things being done, with the right things being, happening.
What was that like, though?
Well, she was incredible. She was also the good friend of a very, very close friend of mine, Bob Cobb, and Bob and Sally Cobb. Bob owns a Brown Derby restaurant. He unfortunately died last year. He's a marvelous, wonderful man. And Sally and I grew up together in Missouri. And they were intimate, intimate friends. In other words, I had the right credentials. And when we had luncheon at Romanoff's, it was...
Not at the Brown Derby.
Not at the Brown Derby, no. It was marvelous. It was like sitting at court because everybody that came by had to stop and say a few words, and everybody had to come and do the whole business, and the little presents would come, the things would happen, and she would pay... no attention to me. She would ask me a question, then I would answer, and then she would look and wave, and it was as though she wasn't, she was paying no attention, which, of course, is a fantastic trick for interviewing, because you're determined, finally, that you're going to say something that makes them pay attention to you. It's just fascinating. But what the Sunday article that finally came out was that she said, first of all, that I was obviously a very determined young lady, and that whatever I set out to do, it was obvious I was going to do it. And I had two beautiful little children. She was very big on, family and children, and that I had was marvelous friends of Bob and Sally Cobb, and she told some stories about we go on picnics with our family. And finally she said, well, it was such a shame that she had to be embroiled in this terrible thing when she first came out here. But obviously she was so young, she didn't know what she was doing. And so I was forgiven for having been so misled in my early days, not to have known what I was doing when I made Citizen Kane.
Did she actually ever ask you any specific questions about Citizen Kane?
By that time, you see, first of all, it was 5 years later. She didn't really want to get into it. That was really the only mention about it. No, she didn't. She didn't want to know about it. She only asked me about me. The other spade work had been done behind the scenes of just say, look, this girl really had not been and didn't know anything about it. She was a very young actress, and, she got a film break, and she didn't know what she was doing. And so it wasn't even mentioned except to say, it was unfortunate she had such a bad beginning, but she really is a very nice, home-loving child, mother and actress and all of that.
She forgave you.
And she forgave me.
What about on a social level now in Hollywood? Were you shunned by some, or...?
I wasn't important enough to be shunned, if you know what I mean. I was new, and I didn't know. You see, fools and young people are really safe, because when you don't know that this is working against you, You don't know enough to be afraid of it. And I knew that it was a... You know, that it was maybe too bad not to be mentioned in the paper, but I had no idea the impact that it meant not to be mentioned in a Hearst paper.
What do you think about the Pauline Kael article in New Yorker?
Well, I thought the first article was brilliant, marvelous research. It was a very good job of research, and substantially true inasmuch as she said that Mankiewicz did write it all out in Victorville, but I know how many times, I know Orson went out there, and I know the script came in and out of this, but I also know Orson told me the story of the thing. He knew the characters and all of this before Mankiewicz even got set down to write it. The concept of Citizen Kane is 100% Orson Welles. The idea, the concept, this whole thing was his. It was his idea totally. Yes, Mankiewicz sat down and wrote most of the script. I doubt that Orson sat at the typewriter much. He wrote ideas, he wrote screenplays, he wrote screen ideas, and he edited. What Mankiewicz is totally responsible for, which is rather ironic, is slanting it toward Hearst as much as he did, because Orson never intended to do that, slant it that much. That's why he made it a composite. Instead of a movie actress, he made it a opera singer, not because he wanted to shield Marion Davies or Hearst, but because Insull had built a Chicago opera house for Hope Hampton, and he really was making a composite of these people. But Mankiewicz had been a guest many times at San Simeon, and he knew what a groovy setting it would be. He knew how pictorially great it would be. And he was the one that added all the things about, he slanted it much more toward Hearst than Orson had in the concept. So to that degree, yes, he influenced the script more. But the one thing, and look at the film. You saw the film. What did it say at the end of the credits? Screenplay by Herman J. Mankiewicz, Orson Welles, in that order. Now, who can argue with that? And Orson had the right. He could have forbidden it. He could have forbidden it. He didn't. He didn't. That there it is. That's the proof. There it is in black and white. But the thing, the main thing is, Orson says that a film is important only if the camera is an eye in the hand of a poet. And I just ask you, Mankiewicz was not on the stage. He was never behind the camera. And every frame and every shot of Citizen Kane was directed by Orson Welles, because I was there and I saw it. And nobody wrote that. That wasn't in the script. He did it. The cameraman was fantastically helpful for him. But I also watched that. He would say to him, now, do you suppose we can do this and this and this? And he would shake his head and he said, well, why don't we try it? And they would try it. And he tried all kinds of things like this. But every frame of that film is Orson Welles. There isn't a frame of it that isn't Orson's work.
Did you do any scenes from Citizen Kane that never appeared on the screen? Do you remember any?
No, I didn't. I didn't do any that wasn't on the. I don't believe there are any. There were some editing, but I would say that of all the pictures I've made, that the picture was the truest to what was written on the paper. Of anything. Now, what we would do sometimes, and now a lot of directors do it, but it had never been done before, since Orson was directing and playing at the same time, he would say, keep the cameras rolling, which they had never done before. Keep the cameras rolling, and he would go back and say, all right, say this line instead of this line, or this line, and then say, all right, say it, do it. In other words, instead of breaking the mood and breaking all of the things, just keep going and keep trying until molding it like a poet would, until he got exactly the effect that he wanted, or the reading, or the word, or whatever like that.
I'm going out to Hollywood in a couple of weeks. Maybe I'll look up Dorothy Cominghore and see what her comments are.
Well, I hope you can find Dorothy Cominghore. I really do. Do you know?
I had an address for her a few years ago, and since then I understand she's vanished. I don't know anybody who knows where she is.
That's the saddest thing about the whole thing, the very saddest thing. Orson was rather rude to her at times, that it hurt me. And after a while I said, because he treated me with everybody with such respect. I said, why are you so mean to her, so rude to her? He said, Ruth, forgive me, but I must. She is not really an actress. She is the person, and I must make her hate me, and I'm doing this to make her hate me. She is going to loathe my guts, and it's going to make a brilliant performance.
It came across.
Oh, God, yes. And he said, and what was so sad, he said, you know, she is this person. She will be this person. And I'm not telling anything that isn't known, but right after that picture, she did make one other, the Hairy Ape, which didn't turn out well. And she then looked like an amateur. You know, she really looked like an amateur. I think she was absolutely brilliant in Kane. Absolutely.
Oh, yes,
brilliant.
She was.
No question about it. Absolutely brilliant. But without his direction, without the care that he took with her, she was really just, you know, just like she looked amateurish. And she, no other parts came along, and she started going into Musso Frank's around 11:30, and she'd sit at the bar and order the martinis. And by noon, when other people got there, she was saying, you know, they say I drink too much. And she was playing the scene at the end of Cain within 2 years after it was shot. And then she married, you know, Richard Brooks, had two children. I guess the drinking and the other thing. Anyway, they were divorced. He got custody of the children. And I'll never forget the horror of seeing her picture in the news. I was here in like 1955, 56. She had been arrested for pandering on Hollywood Boulevard. And it was just, you know, just this total thing. And the picture looked like that last shot of her in, you know, where she's at the nightclub, this.
Now I've got to find her.
I hope you can. I hope you'll find her, because I know she was in a hospital for a time after that. And I hope, I pray, really, with all my heart, I hope you find her and that she's well.
There's so many sad stories like that out there. Ruth Wark has been in some other very interesting films, did some very nice work in Guest in the House, which I enjoyed very much.
Oh, thank you. I love that picture.
Journey into Fear, and I wish we had more time. We could talk about those films. Maybe she'll come back. Do you know where I enjoyed seeing you the most?
Where?
You'll never guess.
I never.
In Bryant Park at the women's rally, at the women's strike for, it wasn't women's strike for peace. It was the day that the women's lib paraded down Fifth Avenue.
Right.
Yeah, and you were too far away because I wanted to walk over and talk to you.
Oh, good.
It was nice to see you there.
Thank you. I was also very proud. I was in the Jeanette Rankin Peace March.
I know Miss Rankin.
Right.
Yeah, lovely woman.
Yes, I was arm in arm with Mrs. King on that occasion.
Ruth Warwick has been here, reliving her role of Mrs. Kane in the American classic motion picture Citizen Kane, and I want to thank her very much for giving that splendid performance and weathering the storm that followed, and for the other performance she's given in some of the other films. I mentioned Guest in the House and Journey into Fear, and for standing up with women when the bandwagon is offering still immediate seating. I'm behind you 100%, right on. This is Richard Lamparski. I want to thank you for listening, and have a nice evening.
Thank you.